Cash transfers are exciting, perhaps because they offer the opportunity to help others in a tangible, visible way. And I think technology also has helped a lot in increasing that interest. And they offer also contact with beneficiaries also for providing other services. So it's not just a program, an end in itself, it's actually a window into people's lives.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Cash transfer schemes have grown in popularity in many parts of the world in the past few decades. Cash may be provided directly to households living in poverty on condition that the households or individuals fulfill specific conditions, such as minimum attendance of children in schools and/or attendance at health clinics. Such programs are popularly termed as conditional cash transfers or CCTs and create incentives for households to adjust their behavior towards nationally accepted social goals. But governments have realized that providing cash without any form of conditionality can also be effective in advancing human development. Scholars have argued that rather than waiting for economic growth to take off, governments may decide to reallocate public spending by simply providing cash directly to citizens. Indeed, numerous studies find that cash transfer programs can be one of the most effective social protection tools at our disposal in the fight against poverty. There's now also growing empirical evidence of how cash transfers can provide quick relief during major economic crises, such as the pandemic that we've all experienced recently. In addition to economic effects, cash transfers may also change gender hierarchies and improve the position of women in local society. There are studies that show that cash transfers increase school attendance and also improve nutrition. It is therefore no surprise that cash transfer programs have been warmly embraced by many civil society organizations and international agencies. But is it all win-win? What works and what does not? And how can cash transfers be made even more effective as a tool for global development? To discuss these issues, I'm joined by Ugo Gentilini, who is an economist and the global lead for social assistance at the World Bank. Ugo has worked extensively on the analytics and practice of social protection, including in relation to economic crises, fragility and displacement, and resilience and disaster risk management. He also writes a popular weekly newsletter and is my go-to person on everything to do with social protection. In a new paper on cash transfers in pandemic times, Ugo combines analysis of large data sets with a review of more than 300 pandemic papers, evaluations, and practical experiences, and concludes that there are 10 major lessons we can learn from the largest scale-up of cash transfers in history. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ugo, it's lovely to see you. I've enjoyed reading your work over the years. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Big fan of your show.
Let's get cracking, Ugo. There's so much attention on cash transfers these days. Everyone is talking about it. It's the aid agencies like the Norwegians are talking about it. Academics are studying it. Just last year alone, 95,000 academic titles cropped up in your Google search. 1.3 million papers over the last three decades have been published on this topic. So just for the benefit of our listeners, let's begin by asking you a very simple question. Since you work with this on an everyday basis in the World Bank, what is a cash transfer? How would you define this very simply? What does it entail? And what are the different types of forms and shapes that these cash transfers end up taking in various parts of the world?
So Dan, you're absolutely right that when we talk about cash transfers, we are actually talking not about one program, but about a family of diverse programs that have very different objectives, design features, and effects. You could think of cash transfers provided conditioned on certain activities like sending kids to school or conditioned on work. And they, in that case, are called the public works programs. Or you could think of cash transfers that are meant for people of a certain age, for example, to seniors. They're called social pensions. They can be targeted based on some welfare measure, or they can be provided to everyone in society. That's the famous debate on universal basic income. They can be provided regularly over time, every month, or just on a one-off basis. They can be small in terms of benefits, or they can be very significant. They can transfer a very significant amount of cash, sometimes as part of wider integrated programs that also transfer assets, provide skills, and other interventions. So it's very important to, when we speak about cash transfers, to be clear on what program we are discussing.
Why this sudden burst of interest? Is it based on some of the work that some economists are doing? I think I remember Andy Sumner a couple of years ago and many others who basically came up with a very simple prescription saying, come on, let's stop doing anything else. This is the magic bullet. So somehow cash transfers have assumed this wonderful blueprint. It's the solution to all our ills. Does that explain this radical increase in interest in cash transfers?
Then you're right. When about the increase in interest in academia, I was stunned when estimating that 1.3 million papers produced over the past 40 years. I'm not sure if any other development intervention has been studied so much in depth. Let me say that cash transfers are exciting, perhaps because they offer the opportunity to help others in a very concrete, tangible, visible way. And I think technology also has helped a lot in increasing that interest. And they offer also kind of an opportunity, a point of contact with beneficiaries also for providing other services. So it's not just a program, an end in itself, it's actually a window into people's lives. But also I have to say that, you know, this excitement is matched by an equal level of debate.
Yes.
And this is because philosophical, societal, political, economic, and practical forces are fused and coalesced very powerfully in a single program. So when you look at cash transfers, they sort of intersect with contentious debates at various levels. The first, it's about mindsets and attitudes towards redistribution. Take the question of whether to provide transfers in kind or cash, a question that has been for us for centuries. In some societies, cash is something that you earn, while food is something that you deserve. So the notion is that you need to put effort to earn cash, and this is something that has deep historical roots. So this also means that these philosophical questions are reflected in specific design choices, and they affect whether and what conditions or responsibilities to have in place, whether to provide transfers in cash or in kind, or whether and how to target beneficiaries. And as you said, there is debate on where they fit within the broader development discourse. And here there are kind of two extreme views. On one hand, there is the narrative of poverty, simply the lack of cash. So just to give people cash and problem solved. On the other extreme, the narrative that poverty is totally about structural power imbalances. So cash is even a distraction from addressing the real drivers of inequities. I think there is some truth in both. There is middle ground, and I don't see them actually as mutually exclusive.
When I think about cash transfers, I'm often reminded of something that my students told me many years ago. And listeners of the show have heard me talk about this, that after having taught what does not work for a whole term, they were frustrated. They said, you know, tell us what actually works because we want to do development. There needs to be some hope. And so I devised this What Works course, Promising Practices in International Development. And one of the big success stories in many ways is cash transfers, however way you look at it. And so I think there's always been this interest in cash transfers as something that works. It is relatively simple. It's easy to understand. But as you also said, there's sometimes also a pushback because perhaps it doesn't address all the structural inequalities. And in some rich countries, of course, people have reacted, particularly in the UK, saying, why should we give money, free dough to people? But we'll get back to the arguments for and against. I'm just thinking about the fact that Lula was just reelected in Brazil. And he has often been seen to be a champion of Bolsa Família, very successful redistribution program. You have a long history in Latin America with Mexico, Progresa, Oportunidades, Prospera, as it is called now. So all of these cash transfer programs, Hugo, as I've read over the years, were successfully championed in Mexico, in Brazil, and then it sort of caught on in the whole of Latin America. But when that model of conditional cash transfers, I have to mention here, that you actually get money, a household gets money in return for doing certain things like sending children to school, getting a health checkup or whatever. That conditional cash transfer model, when one tried to apply it elsewhere, I'm thinking about in South Asia, in India, it didn't catch on. When one tried to do the same kind of conditionality model in sub-Saharan Africa, it didn't catch on. So could you reflect a bit on this historical evolution of the conditional cash transfer model and how increasingly we see perhaps in some parts of the world, including on the African continent, more of the unconditional cash transfers that have become more popular?
Yeah, you're 100% right, Dan. In part, I think the origin of cash transfers in recent decades can be traced back to some of the Latin American experiences that had particular design. Some of that design is still in place. Some has been replaced with something else. I think of Mexico that has moved in a different direction with cash transfers 3 years ago. I would say that the design has in fact evolved. And if we look at, first of all, the magnitude of the expansion already in the early 2000s, the number of unconditional cash transfers has increased really exponentially. If you look at trends really around 1999, 2000, 2001, there is a steep acceleration worldwide. And in part, it reflects the diversity of conditions and preferences and appetite for other forms of transfers. Sometimes the supply of services upon which transfers or condition may not be there, or the attitudes towards redistribution as such that an unconditional cash transfer is preferred. And also, there is such a range of ways to design programs. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes you have a simple unconditional cash transfers that can work very well. Other times, there is information that is provided alongside that transfer. For example, some training in nutritional information or feeding practices that are not conditioned per se. You don't get excluded from the program if you don't fulfill or you don't attend the training, but it comes with the program, and they have been proved to work quite well. So there is a spectrum of options, and we have seen a lot of diversity. So some of the conditional cash transfer programs still exist, and many variants from kind of quasi-conditional to fully unconditional are present in different parts of the world. Perhaps with the recent pandemic, there has been a further acceleration on unconditional transfers because of the nature of the pandemic. So programs were simplified in many ways. And there is also, I think, interest out there in having unconditional cash transfers as a sort of a benchmark against which you could compare the cost and benefits of programs that are slightly more complex or sophisticated or integrated and see what works best.
So let me raise two issues. One has to do with why I think some of the programs that worked in Latin America did not perhaps work elsewhere. There are all kinds of cultural, national, contextual issues here, of course. But one had to do, if I recall correctly, with the lack of adequate infrastructure. not having banks or ATM machines available. In those days, in the early days, or even a few decades ago, we were not talking about digital payments. We were thinking about giving somebody virtually or transferring that amount, right? And there were some issues with political intermediaries, middlemen, etc. But just getting the cash to people was often more of a challenge, I think, on the African continent a few decades ago than it is now, perhaps, because now mobile technology has taken off. And similarly, this was also a problem to reach out to, say, rural parts of India. That infrastructure issue, I thought, was a big challenge, but perhaps you can say something about how that has developed, because given this technological progress that we've all witnessed, including during the pandemic, I'm sure issues of targeting, identification, perhaps are a little easier now than before. That's one thing. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is whether the evidence about conditional cash transfers, if I read correctly, there isn't really that much evidence saying that the conditional aspect of cash transfers are better than the unconditional. So that's why, let's just go to the unconditional aspect. So if you could clarify that for me and my listeners, that'll be great.
No, absolutely. I think that, in recent decade or so, perhaps the past couple of decades, but even more so the past 5 years, the frontier of what is possible has expanded enormously. Sometimes innovations happen when they are planned, and sometimes they happen when you are under pressure.
You mean like during the pandemic?
For sure. So the moment that governments did have information on about 15 or 20% of the population, and those people were already receiving transfers as part of routine interventions, and then you have a shock that affects 80% of the population, how do you reach that missing 60%, especially for informal sector workers?
Yes.
And other categories of populations that are neither eligible for social insurance, nor do they participate in cash transfer programs. And there we have seen an explosion of innovations in how to outreach and let people know that programs exist. I think of Colombia, Morocco, other countries that have invested a lot in letting people know through social media and other vehicles about what's available for them. The use of apps, the use of technology for enrollment, skipping a number of steps that are normally required for participation and verification of, for example, people's income. And basically, access was made easier, and that increased coverage enormously. We estimated that about 1.3 billion people received cash between 2020 and 2021. That's historical. That's unprecedented. And I think that within that 1.3 billion, there is even a more incredible figure, which is that 200 million workers were supported by unconditional cash transfers. And if you look at the history of cash transfers, that's quite remarkable, because the sort of programs that normally tend to serve those populations tend to come in the form of public works or active labor markets. Seldom we have seen the state reaching that far in supporting workers with simple cash. And that, in my mind, is quite a historical shift. By the way, Dan, as we speak, this is not just about COVID. There are about 622 million people that are receiving cash transfers as part of inflation responses. So as the cost of living goes up, the price of food goes up. Since April, countries have been using cash again to respond to another huge crisis, and cash seems to be, again, the primary vehicle for addressing it.
Ugo, let's talk a bit about what works and what has been a challenge. When you look at the literature, when you look at the evidence, when you look at what the bank has been doing, what other agencies and bilateral donors have been doing, How would you classify the welfare effects of cash transfers, say on poverty reduction, on gender, on schooling, nutrition? If one goes by your Twitter feed, it is all win-win. It seems that everything is really fantastic. And I enjoy reading what you post on Twitter because it is showing that there's a lot of positive effects in terms of maternal and child health, nutrition. It also apparently has economic effects, right? It could have an effect on fiscal and monetary policy. How would you classify, you know, the good news in terms of what really has worked, which in many ways, I think, explains this growing popularity? Maybe there's much more evidence out there that is so persuasive that it is very hard to look away from that.
Thanks for pointing that out. I hope that my tweets don't come across as advocacy.
No, I mean, you're providing the evidence, my friend, of things that are working, which we are very grateful for, because we academics are sometimes too critical.
So I think that the evidence is much stronger in some dimensions relative to others. So that's one way of looking at it. And the other is always compared to what? Compared to what other interventions? So let me stick to the first part. Where do we know that there is more positive evidence, some dimensions relative to others? I think that we can put to rest the debate on whether cash or cash transfers are used wisely. That's been widely proved that people use cash for very desirable purposes. They have an immediate effect on poverty that is almost mechanical. They have very strong effects on food security, dietary diversity, the quality of the foods that people access, and also in increasing attendance and enrollment of education and health services, whether they are conditioned or not. Where they are slightly less effective is when it comes to dimensions that require a lot of other interventions to be achieved. I think of chronic malnutrition and the effect on stunting. There is some positive effect, but it's not very large because it takes so much more than a cash transfer to have good nutrition. The same for learning. When you look at the effects on test scores, it takes much more. We have a lot of evidence on the labor market effects. And I would say that on average, the fears that cash transfers will get people lazy, that they will withdraw from the labor market, that it would hinder labor supply, those are largely overstated. But at the same time, we also don't see a huge effect on increasing that supply as well. So it's kind of neutralish, unless there are particular design features like providing a larger cash transfer for entrepreneurship. And here we have seen also a very long-term effect. There are some studies that look at the persistence of effect and they get up to 12 years, although we see those effects fading a little bit over time. There is evidence on, when it comes to gender, huge reduction in intimate partner violence because of poverty-induced stress that can lead to violence within the household. But transfers themselves are less effective in empowering women more widely. So they have a particular effect on gender-based violence, but not necessarily on other empowerment dimensions. And look, Dan, there are a couple of dimensions also that I think have been are quite fascinating, and they haven't received full attention yet. One is, for example, the psychological dimension. We know that when you're very poor, you're constantly preoccupied, you know, with immediate concerns, such a concentration of worries that are very concrete. It's the here and now.
Yeah.
And the notion that transfers can provide that psychological security and sense of independence and dignity.
You mean predictability, that you can actually, you can expect an income?
You can expect an income that would make you psychologically better. And we know that when there is stress, there is violence, there can be depression, and that can lead to substance abuse, can even lead to suicides. And we have seen that transfers actually had the mitigating effect on all those dimensions. But on the other hand, cash can ironically sometimes also increase stress. So there was this study that came out a couple of months ago that showed that cash transfers actually did produce some very valuable objective effects in well-being. They improved welfare, but people felt worse. And this is because cash represented a moment of hope, but at the same time, they made people realize the magnitude of the unmet needs. And basically, this is not a case against cash, but it shows that transfers operate within a web of hopes, of dynamic needs, of pressures, of expectations. And this ecosystem doesn't often receive full attention, yet it matters a lot for people's well-being.
It reminds me of also what I read in the literature over the years. In some respects, you see a very direct linkage in terms of cash improving certain aspects of daily livelihoods. But in certain other areas, such as cash transfers for HIV prevention, the evidence is less clear. I think I remember reading something saying that sending girls to school, there are incentives to prevent girls from engaging in certain types of activity. That helps, but we can't see a direct impact. In other cases, for example, in relation to cash and migration, there may even be a counter argument that you think that providing cash transfers will reduce the risk of international migration. It turns out it actually increased in certain contexts.
That's
People have more
correct.
money to
That's
migrate.
correct.
One of the earliest debates I remember on this topic, I think it was Kaushik Basu and many others who were involved in this, pros and cons between cash for work or food for work. And this had to do with social protection schemes in India in terms of doing something with unemployment. And there were advantages and disadvantages. If I can recall this correctly, Ugo, some of the arguments in favor of food for work was that because of rising prices, because of inflation, it is much better to provide people with food than with cash. Cash can also be abused. Food is something that makes sure that you survive. It can be used for nutrition purposes, etc. So, how has that debate progressed, do you think? Is there still that kind of disagreement between what works best in certain situations that maybe food is better than cash?
I think that the debate is still there, but it's not as intense as it was at the time of the studies and debates that you mentioned. I think it's fair to say that the use of cash requires certain preconditions. And one of those preconditions is the functioning of markets. So in cases where you don't have a functioning food market, maybe an income transfer can be more effective than a cash transfer. The problem sometimes is how you define a working market, how you measure it, which can be very complex, and there are many different definitions around those. There is evidence also that when prices can get very high, there is a preference by some prospective participants for something very concrete, an in-kind transfer. But at the same time, people do appreciate the flexibility of having a fungible resource like cash because they can decide how to spend it. Sometimes it's there is a rent that is due, and that will be the priority for a household. The debate is still there. It's also, I think, important to think in terms of costs. In principle, when you think of an in-kind transfer, there is more complexity to it.
You mean the in-kind transfers versus the cash?
Correct. So for an in-kind transfer, you need to purchase the food from farmers or wholesalers. You need to store it, you need to transport it, and you need to distribute it. So that logistics tend to make cash transfers more cost effective, but there can be also cases where there are some exceptions. And especially in cases where you have very limited food availability, sometimes when you purchase in-kind transfers in large quantities, you can get a huge price discount, and that price discount can offset the entire logistics that cash transfers entail. But that's very much the exception. And we see that now, on average, cash transfers tend to be up to about 23% more cost effective than an equivalent transfer in kind. And there is also, I think, a middle ground, which is the vouchers. Those are the schemes that you don't need to procure anything. You provide a transfer or provide access to people to buy food for a given quantity or quality in predefined stores, and they have access to it. So it's kind of a restricted form of cash that is sometimes used. And if we look at history, a number of cash transfer programs actually have undergone that transition of shifting from in-kind vouchers to cash. And the more we see urbanization coming up, and the more markets are integrated and the more technology makes transfers very fast and efficient, it is likely that even humanitarian assistance is going to be more and more provided in cash transfers, not only in terms of social protection. And we have seen that now, for example, about 20% of humanitarian assistance is provided in the form of cash transfers, something that was definitely not the case like two decades ago.
Yeah, when you talk about food, you're absolutely right, because I've done studies of this in India, and one of the big problems is actually food storage. Even if you solve the acquisition and the distribution, just making sure that the food doesn't rot in the godowns, in the storage houses, that is a nightmare. And it also turns out that we can't expect people living in poverty to actually be given bad quality food. Sometimes they say they would like the freedom to choose what they buy. You know, when you get it from, say, a government fair price shop, they say that the quality of the rice is bad. So, you know, why should we eat bad quality rice? But talking about some other issues, Ugo, when I look at the literature, it turns out that by and large, there's an overwhelming body of evidence saying that cash transfers are good, they work, and as you rightly pointed out, they have maybe more clear effects in certain sectors than in others, but the general evidence is that it works. But one area where there also appears to be some sort of consensus, and maybe, you know, you'd like to reflect on this, is the fragmentation that takes place across various programs in certain countries, the lack of administrative capacity. I mentioned this earlier, you know, the whole set of issues related to targeting, registration, proof of identity, and then, of course, the logistics of actually distributing the cash through mobile phones or through a bank card. There's this whole infrastructure-related aspect that I would like you to reflect, if you can, whether we have now reached a point where all of these can be bypassed to a certain extent. But there are certain other things that perhaps can't be bypassed. I was reading this study from Colombia from 2018, where the author talks about the centrality of queues. You know, there's still, you queue up for something, you know, you register and then you queue up for another thing. And there's another queue. There's all kinds of delays to just actually get the cash. So have we moved beyond this, or do we still have these logistical challenges out there that needs to be fixed?
Yeah, sometimes we may get the impression that everything now works perfectly well, yeah. But I am convinced that it works much better than just a few years ago. If we look at how information systems are developing nearly everywhere in the world, that's fairly remarkable on the information that governments have about what programs are available out there. I think the information on how they work as well, but of the variety of delivery options that you have on the table. If you think of, I mentioned earlier, how to let people know that something exists, you don't need to go door by door. There are so many platforms that one could tap, same for payment options, and also inviting people to provide information themselves, so you don't have necessarily, again, to go out and collect it. There are so many databases that could be tapped and used. We have seen that whether they're CV registries or whether it's information that the health sector has or in education, there is much more of a kind of government-wide approach to social protection than there was just until recently. But of course, there are so many programs out there. Sometimes it's hard to take stock of how many there are, including a central and a local level. the variety of actors. Sometimes one government department doesn't necessarily coordinate with another. What is going on in the development sphere or in the humanitarian assistance sphere? And sometimes there are things that are going on in parallel. A figure comes to mind, since we discussed humanitarian assistance earlier, you know, about 0.5% of the 30 billion humanitarian assistance out there per year is channeled through government structures. And sometimes this is for good reasons, other times less so. But it just gives a flavor of the systems within the system that are available in a country. And sometimes even a cash program that is intended to reach similar populations in similar areas, even with similar design, may sometimes suffer from coordination problems because of different actors not using the same systems.
For me, there are two sets of actors that can facilitate but also be a hindrance in rolling out cash transfer programs. One is, of course, the political actors, the political intermediaries, the middlemen who may want to take credit saying, Ugo, I'm giving you the money, but vote for me. So you basically be thankful, right? So that aspect, that it becomes more like a charity case rather than a right of citizens. So if we can cut out the middlemen, if we can cut out that kind of political capital that you're getting this because of some leader, some savior, that would be great. So that's one aspect. The other category of people I find who play a very important role are bureaucrats. It could be street level bureaucrats who sometimes may end up doing certain things or performing certain acts that are unintended, not a part of the program, like maybe making sure that there is proper behavior of the recipients, you know, whether it is school going or health checkups or whatever. They may even be willing to ignore or hide some of the not so nice behavior in order to make something look much better than they really are. So what do you think about these two groups of people? And in addition, of course, now you have increasingly civil society organizations involved. So it's not just governments, as was the case in Latin America. Now you have a whole variety of actors getting into this cash field.
That's correct. So actors have increased enormously, and that brings more options, in a way also more competition, but also increases the premium and the importance of coordination. But then I think there is even a third layer here. Mm-hmm. And while we discuss the evidence, while we discuss delivery and actors, there is a structural issue as well. If we look at how tax and transfer systems work at the moment.
Yeah.
So that means how much people receive in total. So if you tax them on one hand and then provide transfers on the other, how much is left at the end of the day? And if we look at what's going on in low-income countries, the poorest 10%, the poorest 20%, they tend to be net payers, which means that you can have a very effective program supported by the best available evidence, incredibly well coordinated, informed by state-of-the-art information systems, and yet those structural issues will hinder its performance. And this is because sort of a perverse effect of, on one hand, very limited coverage. So coverage is still very low. Let's take aside for a moment emergency responses. 1/5 of the poorest quintile or the bottom 20% is covered by some form of social assistance. That's very little. And on the other hand, we look at taxes. Most taxes in low-income countries are indirect taxes. And indirect taxes tend to be a little bit more regressive than direct taxation. So this combination of indirect taxation and low compensation through social protection leads to this outcome of people having to pay more than what they receive.
Yeah.
And that's a, if you wish, an empirical regularity in a number of low-income countries. And then these tax transfer systems become more and more progressive as you look at, as you climb the income ladder. So basically in high-income countries, you start being a net payer around or after the bottom 40% of the population. So that's, I think it's an important issue that is sometimes forgotten in these conversations, that we need to really account for those structural drivers that really are hard to address, but they do affect very concretely any social protection program.
Good point. So when you think about social protection, some of the core social protection instruments, Ugo, generally, I think we're talking about three overarching pillars. So you have social insurance, as in old age pensions, disability, maternity, unemployment, health, whatever, informal savings programs. Then you're talking about labor, certain active labor market programs, you're talking about certain regulations. And then you have the third category of social assistance, which is where the cash transfers are. And in hindsight, and having recently written this paper for the bank about how transfers, cash transfers, were used by governments during the pandemic, what did you find? Because apart from this becoming increasingly popular, it seems to me, having read your paper, that among all of these core instruments of social protection, there was something about cash transfers that made governments choose it as a tool in this crisis, even in situations where countries perhaps did not have well-established social protection programs, cash transfer seemed to be almost an easy way out to resolve some of the challenges. I know that solving informal sector related problems is a challenge, but still, cash appeared to be a solution. So what did you find, and how did governments actually use this to address these big challenges that the pandemic posed?
If we look at high-income countries, so high level of formality, wage employment, in those countries, wage subsidies were used extensively, and they were a very direct way of providing support. So keep paying people while staying home, those that were already earning a wage. So at the same time, the pandemic has shed light on the gaps in the system and the fact that, for example, the self-employed or people in non-standard employment or short-term gigs, etc., weren't really well covered by social insurance, nor by social assistance. And so countries like Italy and Cyprus and Luxembourg, Austria, Greece, Spain, they all use social assistance significantly to fill those gaps. And doesn't that sound familiar? So the moment that then we look at low and middle income countries, again, this large missing middle within the income distribution that doesn't get either or doesn't get neither cash transfers nor social assistance, the immediate response was to go large scale with cash transfers. We have seen that even, I think, central banks looked at cash. And that's interesting because this is not fiscal policy anymore. It's unconventional monetary policy.
That's correct.
You have low inflation rates, cash transfers, maybe it's the surest route to get the economy back to speed, get people to spend money. So that's why we have seen 13 cases of universal transfers in South Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Serbia, Israel, many other places that gave cash with the hope that it's going to be spent and that that will keep economies alive. So that's also something that under certain macro conditions, low interest rates and widespread shocks, it's maybe a measure that is going to be less and less unconventional moving forward.
Are you saying that maybe the pandemic has made a stronger case in richer countries also for a universal basic income?
It's probably has made the case for universal social protection and the need to cover everyone. And that, you know, if we look worldwide, it's almost aspirational in every country. Some countries are very close to that and others are very far. So I think having a discussion on how to get there is very important. And it speaks to the need to properly combine assistance and insurance and also knowing the limits of both. There are things that assistance can't do in normal times and there are things that the insurance can't do during crisis. So I think you need probably both and the combination and the relative weight of those two arms gonna differ in different contexts. But the notion that you can reach everyone in society when needed, that's it's there. And, you know, even high-income countries had a hard time in reaching everyone.
So targeting is not just a problem in low and middle-income countries.
Oh, it's even more than that. It's like there is a high-income country that decided to go universal, and 20 days after the announcement, 80% of local governments hadn't provided a payment yet because it's hard to reach people from a delivery perspective. So, you know, in a way, let me put it this way, the pandemic has helped share and converge a number of challenges across contexts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like goodbye South-South and hello global. And that, you know, relates to the need to reach people that are normally not reached by social protection systems. It's about having delivery systems that can potentially reach everyone.
I think also I read in your paper that in addition to governments that move center stage, civil society actors played an important role, which is also this kind of diversification. I would like to end, Ugo, where we started. There's so much interest among many actors on cash transfers, but particularly among aid agencies. I mentioned to you Norwegian NORAD has now flagged cash transfers as a major initiative that they'd like to promote. So do you have any words of advice for aid agencies as they try to navigate this terrain of providing more cash as part of their aid projects?
I would say, very humbly, from my perspective, try to see where they fit in the system first. I think there is a need to have systems that can flex, and that, you know, the more we could have some form of automatic stabilizer, the better. There is always going to be a role and space for discretionary spending, for the policy space, but somewhat anchoring scale-up decisions on some early warning systems that track risks and that have triggers and that can inform scale-up down the line, I think that could be a very promising avenue. I would also think of being a very honest knowledge broker. There is so much that is going on worldwide that I think the international community could facilitate a lot of that exchange. When speaking to some ministers or policymakers during the pandemic, and especially about, you know, 6 months down the road, they all said, I wish I knew this from day one, or I wish what was going on elsewhere immediately. I think there is so much that we could think of, you know, in the ways in which we could assist policymakers in get them the best knowledge. And also, words matter. And I always had a bit of a problem with the word convincing others.
You mean being persuasive enough?
Well, you know, convincing sometimes sounds like you know something that others don't, right? I think we have to understand where others are coming from, what they would like, where they want to go, their worldview, and give them the best available evidence globally and from different contexts in a very objective way, and being able to help inform implementation and adaptations within the very economic and political ecosystems within which people operate. You're going to have Stefan Derkan in this series, and I think he's making a strong case for understanding politics and how much it matters. I think that is part exactly of this conversation, and it's an important element in the cash transfers agenda as well.
It has been such a pleasure to chat with you. Just seeing you at home in DC makes me want to travel back to DC as soon as I can. But I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for coming on my program today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. You are too kind, and let's reciprocate. I very much look forward to get back to Norway.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please spread the news among friends and colleagues and share the link to the podcast on social media. You can tag us on Twitter at GlobalDevPod and Dan Bannick.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Bannick from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.